Welcome to episode 12 of the R Squared podcast. I'm your host, Ian Levy. Today's guest is Dr. Jeremy Abramson, a computer scientist and researcher who also teaches a sports analytics class at the University of Southern California. Today's episode, Jeremy and I talk about the educational side of basketball analytics, the current state of the industry, rooting for the Kings. So, Jeremy, for readers of Nylon Calculus who are maybe not that active on Twitter, you might be an unfamiliar name and an unfamiliar face. So, I'm wondering if you can give listeners just a little bit of your background.
Okay, my name is Jeremy Abramson, and you can find me on Twitter at Jeremy Abramson. I'm a computer scientist. I have a PhD in computer science from the University of Southern California. And I do research in a number of different aspects of computer science that have nothing to do with sports. But I also teach a class, an introductory class in sports analytics at USC.
Cool. Well, we have an array of topics we'd like to get to in this conversation, but of personal interest to me is kind of the education front, so that's where I wanted to start. So I met you at the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference last year, and you were on a panel called From the Classroom to the Locker Room, Teaching the Next Generation of Sports Analysts. So how did you get connected with the conference, and how did you sort of end up on that panel?
First of all, that video I think now is finally available free on YouTube. So if you want to go check it out, go check it out. I've got my pitches in. But when I was developing the curriculum, for the course, I reached out to pretty much all of the people who taught courses that I could find. There was, some people at Georgia Tech, I think Wayne Winston at Indiana. And one of the people that I reached out to was a guy by the name of Michael Magazine at the University of Cincinnati. And he had been involved with Sloan, I think, reviewing research papers. So we started talking and I said, hey, we're kind of in this, not very large club of people who actually try to teach this stuff. Is there space for a panel about not necessarily the analytics themselves, but like, how do you actually teach this to other people, and he said, yeah, we've thought about that before, but I'll see about pitching it again. And he got in contact with some of the people who put the conference on, and eventually they decided it was a good idea. And I ended up, because of that interaction, ended up on the panel.
And I really enjoyed it. It was one of my favorite things at the conference this year. And for anyone who has any interest in the education side of analytics, it's definitely worth finding that video. And we'll put it up in the show notes too. So how long, how many semesters or how many times through have you taught this sports analytics class?
Actually, just once. Well, last in the spring. It's on the docket again for this upcoming spring, so looking forward to doing it again and figuring out, making some tweaks about what worked and what didn't work.
So how many, how big was the class, and then what was sort of what was the structure of the class?
The class was as big as it could possibly be. They gave me a lecture hall with 49 seats, and I had 49 students. Which was sort of, I guess flattering as a first-time instructor, but also really kind of, I probably didn't need to teach a class that big for my first go of university teaching, but yeah. Whatever. So the class was very introductory. It was, because of the way it was scheduled as a special topics, which by some archaic rule in the USC registration means you can't have prerequisites. So I had everything from literally second semester freshman communications majors to say electrical engineering master students. Mm-hmm. And so I had to sort of construct a curriculum that would, didn't cater to one group more so than the other. So I tried to teach them more about things like these are some of the concepts that teams are using or the media outlets are using. Here's some statistical concepts. We used Mathletics a little bit as a textbook, the book by Wayne Winston, just because it's a good kind of introductory explanation of different. It covers a bunch of different sports. So we went through, we started I think in baseball and went through basketball and then football and talked about some different sports. And the kids they did some, you know, sort of book reports on, you know, different articles that they found interesting, and then did a project at the end.
And the projects at the end were students sort of creating metrics and models, or were they mostly using existing stuff to try and explain something or sort of tell a story or shed light on something?
Mostly the latter. Yeah. There wasn't a ton of people with significant technical backgrounds. There was a couple, but most of them, even the ones that were, you know, either computer science or math or maybe economics majors, they were underclassmen. So they didn't really have the skill set to really do a lot of that on their own. Mm-hmm. Hopefully soon they will. but so most of them, you know, I was actually very impressed with the quality of the projects. They were actually very interesting. And it was especially interesting to see the variation in topics, you know, I pretty much didn't restrict what they could do whatever they wanted. And so some people were, you know, it was just really interesting to see, like, like I said, like the variation of the different topics. Not everyone chose, you know, should you go for it on fourth down or things like that. People had, the class had really, really diverse interests.
Did you feel like the technical side was more the limitation for students, or was it sort of the, like conceptual understanding, sort of applications of analytics?
I would say the technical side. Most of them had, you know, most of them said, oh, if we could only, you know, get a number that told us this, or if there was only a metric for that, you know, that most of them kind of understood that, you know, that sort of nature, but they just didn't really know how to go about doing that. They also, like I said, were a lot of them were lower division undergrads, so they didn't necessarily have sort of a general research background. Mm-hmm. Like they didn't, you know about literature surveys and things like that, you know. So there's a lot of them where I had to say, oh, you know, that's kind of already been done before. You should go make sure, you know, go look at the draft initiative in 2009 that ESPN did. Go look at A2 games charts. You know, people have talked about these sorts of things. So that was another limiting factor, that they just hadn't really done those kinds of projects before.
You know, I pay mostly attention to basketball analytics. I'm sort of vaguely familiar with analytics stuff in other sports, but what are some of the threads when you're teaching a class like that? What are some of the threads that sort of cut across all the different sports in terms of analytics? Or did you find that you were sort of jumping from sports-specific topic to sports-specific topic?
I mean, to be very, very broad, the two, you know, there's obviously like on court and kind of like predictive, right? So you you can look at it as sort of valuation versus on court, right? Mm-hmm. So you want to, you know, valuation is things like who to draft, how much, you know, or how much, you know, what sort of qualifying offers to give to people, things like that, that kind of analytics. And then there's obviously on, you know, it's not really on court, on field, whatever.
Yeah.
Those are the sort of the two types of analytics that are, you know, that exist, you know, across all sports.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a sense of, and this might require you sort of guessing, but did you have a sense of the percentage of kids in the class who were interested in this as something more than just, you know, just an elective?
Oh, no, I asked. And weirdly enough, I expected everyone to be like, I want to work for ESPN. And, you know, and strangely, that was really not the case. There was a few that really wanted to work in sports, but, you know, there was one student in particular that, like, you know, at the beginning of the semester really wanted to work in sports, and by the end really wanted to work in real estate. So, you know, and he was like a business econ type. Uh-huh. So, you know, I think he's off at the Wasserman Group interning now, if memory serves. So, you know, that happens, you know. It may have been our first guest speaker was Ben Alomar, and he came in and was like, you're not going to make any money ever. So yeah. that may have dissuaded some people. And he's right, and he's 100% right. But
it's funny, I asked that question because last year I had Steve Shea on the podcast, and he's a mathematics professor at St. Anselm's College, and he teaches a sports analytics class as well. And we talked about the same thing, and he said that he was shocked as well that almost nobody in the class was sort of focused on pursuing this as a career. It was all just sort of like, hey, this sounds interesting. I'd like to sort of check it out and learn a little bit more about that.
Yeah, and that's you know, and that's an interesting question about whether that's because people aren't aware that there are job opportunities, whether mm-hmm. people are aware that they're there, but that it sort of strikes them as fanciful, like wanting to be an astronaut, you know?
Yeah.
Or if people are aware and they think they can do it, but they're just like, that's just not the life for me, you know? Uh-huh. That question I don't know the answer to. It's a very interesting question.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because when I originally went to college, I started at Ithaca College, and my freshman major was sports management. And okay. Heading the clouds a little bit, and my idea was, I'm going to go to Ithaca College, I'm going to major in sports management, and at some point in, you know, maybe 6-7 years, I'm going to be the general manager of an NBA team. And then I got there, and whatever, I don't even remember what my sort of first sports specific class was, but there was like 100 kids in the class, and I was like, there's 100 people in here, and they all have the same idea that I do, and there are 30 of those jobs. And most of these people are way, way smarter than me. And it was funny how, it was weird, but at that time it was like, sort of pulling the curtain back all of a sudden made it seem way less attractive and way less realistic and way less fun than it was before I started learning about it, which is bizarre because at the point I'm at now in my life, learning about this stuff is way more fun and way more interesting. And the more I learn, the more I want to learn, where at that point I was like, maybe I'll try something else.
It's interesting that you mentioned that because in the context of analytics, another thing that Ben Alomar said was, which I thought was kind of surprising and very interesting, was that there really is no career, you know, that if you want to do analytics, you mm-hmm. can do analytics and that can be your job. But he kind of slammed the door on the career path of analytics to like player personnel or to like upper management,
mm-hmm.
Which I thought was kind of interesting because, it's interesting to see if that holds true or if there's, you know, because there were some people in the very beginning, you mm-hmm. know, I remember seeing a job posting in 2005 for like a reasonably high level analyst job at for the Rockets. And it was probably one of the first people that they were hiring, you know, for this whole yeah. like cabal that I remember thinking like, well, you know, and I was like, well, I didn't want to have to move to Houston because mm-hmm. I was actually qualified. It was sort of a technical position. I remember thinking like, but, you know, you take that job. And then, you know, the assistant GM gets hired as a, you know, whatever, and you kind of follow him, and every time you move, you maybe move up a notch, and then, you know, in 10 years, maybe you have some say in, like, player personnel, or you know, it's conceivable. So I remember thinking about that path,
mm-hmm.
and that may not exist anymore.
Yeah.
You know, or there may be this window where it doesn't exist anymore, and then finally, when we have sort of flushed all of the old guard, so to speak, out, and now it's expected that you have to have that background to be in personnel, then it becomes a path again. But for now, it's kind of unlikely. Like, you can be the director of analytics for a team, but that's as good as it's probably going to get.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny, too, because, you know, when analytics people were sort of first becoming ingrained in organizations, a lot of these people were from other backgrounds, you know.
Right.
You look at the early sort of originators on the APBR forum and stuff, a lot of these were people who had skill sets from other disciplines and a passionate interest in sports, and so they were applying skills from other areas, and so you know, you and the other people who are doing this is sort of the first intentional effort to educate sports analytics as a specific discipline, not as an offshoot of economics or computer science or, you know, applied statistics or, you know, whatever else, as part of a bigger discipline.
Yeah, and I'm probably biased, but, you know, the days of seeing people in econ and operations research do this kind of work may be coming to a close. I that's probably a controversial statement, but mm-hmm. but it really is shifting to the amount of data. It really is shifting to sort of, you know, half computer science and, you know, half sort of legitimate statistical analysis and mm-hmm. the sort of the confluence thereof, you know.
Yeah.
That really is the stuff that has sort of an econ flavor or, you know, that is kind of not considered sophisticated. And that's not like really state of the art anymore.
Yeah. You know? Well, talking about your students and having sort of the technical aspect be the barriers, it seems like that's the barrier at all levels, you know. when I started doing this 4 or 5 years ago, I didn't have any background in statistics or analytics at all, and was playing around with Excel spreadsheets and stuff. And I was able to sort of stumble into some things that felt valuable to me. But I'm so far behind the curve technically now that there are ideas that I have that I just I know I'm not going to ever be able to touch because I'm not going to be I'm not going to ever be able to put it together.
And I do want to clarify that when I think of this from like sort of a academic research mm-hmm. perspective, I think about moving sort of that kind of needle.
Yeah.
There's still tons of, you know, of untrodden ground across all levels of sophistication that are at worst interesting things to know and perhaps, you know, interesting columns on some data, you know, relevant mm-hmm. website. But as far as like really, you know, changing the game or whatever, it's Pythagorean theorem is that's old now.
circling back to the class, what do you think about sports analytics as a training or a skill development point for people who are interested in other disciplines? So sort of reversing it, instead of, you know, economics people who are being interested in sports analytics, what about sports analytics as a training for other fields?
If you'd asked me 18 months ago, I would say that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Now I would say that's probably a poor idea. And the reason is simply data availability. That there is vested interest in the medical field, you know, if you want to do data analytics in, you know, helping people not die.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people, as morbid as it sounds, who can make a lot of money on people not dying, you know? Mm-hmm. And so there are, and obviously there's a lot of good that can come out of that as well. So, you know, those kinds of data sets, or civic-based data sets, or, you know, even finance-based data sets, you know, those are available, and those are contexts where you can, you know, that are not, you know, pure theory, so to speak. But mm-hmm. There's just no incentive, you know. Well, there's actually a huge greater good is sort of incentive, but I don't know that there's enough data to support, you know, sort of a 4-year type, it's an entirely sports sort of encapsulated. I guess you could do it, I guess, is the point. But it's everyone would be doing the same exact thing across the country, because there's just not enough data there for everyone to, everyone to not have to share, so to speak.
Gotcha.
An example of that is there are people who are still beating on the same 2011-2012 SportView data, like from half the league. Because that's the only data they have.
Yeah.
And, you know, 2 years, 2.5 years later, if I see a paper next year at Sloan and it's got the same freaking data, that should tell you something.
Yeah. Because that's all there was. Yeah. So one of the things that's interesting to me, because I, you know, the day job is I'm an elementary school teacher, is the idea of sports analytics as an entry point for engagement with math and science for younger high school or middle school students. And it's kind of tricky because...
That's a great idea.
Well, it's tricky on a couple levels. One is that sports is not necessarily an engaging topic for everyone, but,
right.
For some it is. But also it's the same kind of thing where I don't want to say it, like you would sort of, I guess, just be having people trace the progression of models that were already developed. And I guess there's value in that as well, but.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of a different conversation, but I'm wondering why no one, other than maybe it's hard, but you can imagine, why is math not taught sort of modularly? Mm-hmm. Why can't you, you know, other than problem sets, which presumably are the easiest part of teaching math, why can't you pop in everything from, you know, movie box office numbers to sports numbers, to medical numbers, to finance numbers, to whatever, and just sort of teach everything in the context of, you know, although there probably is value in learning conceptual things in a context that you don't necessarily appreciate, but you know.
Yeah. The reason that I cycle back to that is I think about how many things mathematically that I understand and can sort of work with intuitively that came from sports and maybe I sort of already understood them from sports by the time they were taught in school, like the idea of converting fractions into percentages because of figuring out batting averages, you know, that, okay. you know, that you watch somebody's, somebody goes 1 for 7 and their batting average is 14% or whatever. And I think about how many of those things just hook people, and then they aside from the idea of growing kids into the sort of the new Common Core stuff with mathematical modeling, just sort of real basic simple concepts, division, multiplication, addition, and subtraction that can be connected to these statistics that people who are interested in sports would latch onto.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's you know. Do kids still have baseball cards? They still put them on the back and have the stats, and you know,
I still have my collection.
Okay, good. They still have the same crappy gum. I don't know, but no, I mean, I think that's, again, other than, you know, modulo the issue that not everyone is interested in sports. I think it's a great, you know, it does make sense that it is an engagement. It's a way of engaging. It's a way of getting to think about things numerically and teaching, you know, sort of simple concepts, like you say, without a big flashing sign that says this is math and you don't like math, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's a great idea.
Blowing things up a little bit and going going back to the academic world that you're in, how do you see the difference between the way sports analytics is handled in an academic setting versus the way it's handled? I mean, obviously we get snippets of what's going on with teams behind closed doors, but in terms of what's done with sports analytics in the academic setting versus what's done on blogs and, you know, places like the APBR forum and other sort of outlets in the public sector.
Well, I guess, you know, it's interesting that, I mean, there's issues of scale and rigor.
Yeah.
You know, for example, Jenna Weens, who was one of John Gutog's students at MIT, she's the one that, published a 2012 paper, I think, on crashing the boards.
Yeah.
I mean, so her expertise is not sports. Her expertise is, you know, medical data. So she just happened to get this data set and happened to apply, like, stuff that she knows how to do, and then out comes this, like, this paper, you know? So it's, you get, like I said, and, you know, presumably the people, you know, someone who's getting their PhD in computer science at MIT might have a different idea on quote unquote research than people who are writing for a blog, you know?
Yeah. And that's sort of the heart of my curiosity. I think about, all the controversy with David Barry and the Wages of Wins and that he, you know, there was a lot of controversy about that. And part of his defense was that this work is peer-reviewed, and this comes through this sort of academic channel and this academic framework of peer review and validation, and so on some level that justifies the work.
It's an interesting question, but I think another question is, forgive me, but like, who cares? Like that one of the interesting things about all of this is whose needle are we moving here? And if it really is just kind of, no, my version of WAR is better. No, my version of WAR is better. Well, then that's, I mean, I don't know if that matters all that much.
Yeah.
You know, if it's actually moving someone's needle on a franchise or, you know, I mean, in some sense, the game is what matters, right? So, you know, I mean, I don't know if I necessarily, I mean, it is a different process, you know. I don't know. I'm actually not super familiar with, I mean, I'm familiar with Dave Barry, but I'm not super familiar. Was he arguing with Wayne Winston or Roland Beach or who? I don't remember exactly. I vaguely know what you're talking about, but I don't exactly know the controversy.
Well, there was some controversy between the Wages of Wins and his wins produced metric and people who advocated for plus minus and advanced plus minus models, and they were sort of going back and forth. And I know that one of his arguments, and he had many arguments about the validity of wins produced and problems that he saw with plus minus metrics. And I'm not commenting on that at all because I like Barry's work, and I've used wins produced in the past, and I've used plus minus models too. But I know that one of his arguments was my work came through this academic framework and my work is peer reviewed and your work is not. And so it can't be judged on the same scale. And maybe mischaracterizing slightly, but that was my understanding of one piece of his argument.
Right. The interesting thing about that is that, back when he was doing that, the set of people that were qualified to actually, from a sports perspective, qualified to actually intelligently talk about that sort of stuff, that's a tiny group of people.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, it's, and which, again, not to bring back Ben, but that's why he started, you know, the Journal of Quantitative Analytics and Sports, is because there was no sort of outlet for that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a new one. I forget. It has a shorter name. It's maybe just the Journal of Sports Analytics. I don't remember exactly. But if you look at, you know, the editorial board for that new journal, it's like a who's who. And it's, and hopefully, you know, I think the people who, really consume this sort of stuff, like the heavier sports analytics stuff, they're usually really smart people. 'Cause why else would you bother? So, you know, you're not going to go read a sort of a mathy article just for the hell of it if you don't understand what it's saying, you know. So I think at this point, it's kind of a tight group of people that you can almost get that sort of academic, you know, it's almost at this level of the stage of the game, it's almost the same process. If I was to put something on the web versus something on a journal, the same 100 people would look at it and the same 100 people would provide feedback regardless of where it came out. That may not have been true back, you know, when that, the issue you're talking about was happening, but now I think it probably is about the same, and that may change. I don't know. But, you know, there are not that many consumers, or I don't say consumers, but there are not that many people who really could understand what it is. The people who can understand this, they're the same
regardless.
Web. Yeah, exactly.
And you don't think it dilutes the, I don't know if it's the right phrase, but dilutes the discussion if there's the same 100 people are looking at it on the web, but there's also 1,000 more people who don't totally understand it and are shouting about it and arguing about it. You don't think that dilutes the discussion or confuses the issue?
Yeah, but I mean, that's true of anything, right? I mean, are we supposed to start
the function of the internet to some degree?
Yeah, but before the internet, it's the function of the loud guy at the water cooler. Like it's, you know what I mean? Like this is something that happens when people discuss things. So I don't know how much sense it makes to worry about it.
Gotcha. All right. Well, we'll move away from that. So, when did your interest in science, math, and computers start overlapping with sports? Was that something that was, you know, from when you were a kid, or was that something that came later?
It really came later. It's funny you mentioned the and I always get my P and my B mixed up, but the APBR.
Yeah, APBR. Yeah.
There you go. You know, I remember, like, you know, I have private messages from Kevin Payne and from Ed Kupfer and all these, you know, I remember all those guys back then when I was like, oh, there's these people who are doing this stuff and it's really, really cool. And so I would say around 2003, 2004, it was sort of a welcome distraction from finishing my dissertation, really. The strange thing is it didn't even occur to me, because it was at that point it was so new, that you could even do this in an academic setting, that you could actually do, you know, it was all hobby work for people. You know what I mean? Like, you know, every once in a while on a lark, some operations research professor would publish a paper about, you know, scheduling baseball umpires, and everyone would go, oh, that's cute. You know, no one took it seriously. Mm-hmm. And certainly no one took it seriously in terms of actually affecting on game or on court outcomes. I mean, that was, no one took that seriously, you know? So it's, in some sense, I was sort of born too early. So it happened later in life when I found out that, you know, there are other people who have sort of technical backgrounds that are really interested in sports and they're looking at some pretty cool things. The context that I got the most interested in personally was, I'm really interested in team composition.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested in trade valuations and draft valuations and how teams are built. Which, like you, I also have a huge interest in the NBA, and unfortunately, those two things you know, one of the things I struggle with, to sort of slightly digress, in the NBA is we have all of this, you know, really smart people doing, you know, really cool stuff, and it's debatable how much it's going to move the needle because the team with LeBron usually wins. You know, and it makes you wonder, like, it makes you wonder that you know, if you could hire a team of four people and pay them $250,000, and the Hawks would move from a 6 seed to a 5 seed.
Yeah, and is that's that worth the investment?
That's what the analytics buys you. Like, you say, okay, you know, owner of the Hawks, $250,000, 6 seed to a 5 seed. I don't know if they would do it. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. It's funny. So, it's something that I talked with Seth Partnow on the last podcast about, that we spend so much time talking about analytics and the ways that it's changed the game that we sometimes lose track of the fact that those changes are small in the grand scheme of things, and that, you know, 50 years ago they were still playing basketball and they were still scoring points and they still dribbled the ball up the floor and somebody won and somebody lost and there was still a championship every year. You know, and for all the market inefficiencies that have been identified, and all the, you know, the minute advantages that have been gained, you know, it's still basketball.
I mean, if you remember that article that I think Michael, the Moneyball guy, again, I'm
Michael Lewis,
his name. Yeah, wrote about Shane Battier. Uh-huh. I forget, and you know, it was about how, and this was when he was with his Rockets, and it was about how all this analytics taught him where Kobe, I think it was Kobe. Well, yeah. Where, like, and but the point is Kobe made the shot. And I get that it's process, not outcome. Uh-huh. But you know, we're a results based organization here at some, yeah, point. You know, so it and the funny thing is if, like, let's look at something on a grand scale, like, mm-hmm, don't take mid range jumpers, which is, you know, sort of been overblown a bit.
Yeah,
but. Okay, so maybe a bunch of analytics, either, you know, complicated or not complicated, taught us that don't take mid-range jumpers. Well, you don't need analytics to know that anymore. You know what I mean? You can fire your analytics staff and tell your team, don't take mid-range jumpers, and they would be just as good at doing that as anybody else. So it's, and obviously, you know, then the argument is, we'll go find the next sort of advantage. But, you know, it makes you wonder how many of those there really can be in a sport that is kind of so, I don't want to call it isocentric, but, uh-huh, you know, it is sort of a singular, you know, individual athlete sport like basketball. I mean, football, for example, I really don't think will look anything like football now, 15 years from now. Like, I think there is so much room to move the needle there because there's just so many moving parts that, mm-hmm, nobody understands. And there's so much kind of antiquated fossil kind, you know, it's a little bit like baseball, you know, in the early 2000s, there's just so much just like dinosaur thinking in, mm-hmm, football. There's dinosaur implementation in basketball. I mean, hi, Byron. Hi, Byron. How you doing? you know, the dinosaur thinking in basketball is much less than it used to be.
It's funny because I feel like one of the things that I've been to Sloan 3 years and it's always a big topic is like, is that the barrier is communication, that it's,
that's the new scouts versus stats, like, sort of banner is like, it's all about how you present it.
Yeah. It's like the findings are indisputably useful. It's just, we've got to figure out how to explain it in a way that generates buy-in. But it's funny because it still seems like all of the effort goes into the analytics as opposed to the communication. It doesn't seem like the growth on the communication side is keeping pace with the technical side at all.
Well, I mean, I remember, I want to say it was 2013, you know, Buck Showalter told some anecdotal story about how analytics had said some guy was going to be a center fielder, and then he knew he wouldn't be a center fielder, and lo and behold, he was a crappy center fielder. And he's like, therefore, analytics are stupid. From my experience with teams and from other people who have talked, you know, there really isn't that many people out there like that anymore.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, and I think Stan Van Gundy, I forget the example he had last year, but, you know, he addressed that where he was like, it's okay, fine, buy in, great, I will, uh-huh, take whatever, but the guy still got to do what, you know, the people, Stan Van Gundy's not playing. Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, if, if Stan Van Gundy has all the buy-in in the world, that's not really going to help Tobias Harris's rotations, or, you know, if he's not in the Magic anymore. But you get the idea, you know. So it's still a bunch of people in shorts running around, and they still have to do what they're supposed to do. And, you know, buy-in can help that, but it can't get you over the hump completely.
One of the other things that Seth and I were talking about the last time was this idea too, that the perception that these some of these insights, because they have been verified or validated by mathematical models and things like that, that they are somehow new. Whereas there have been guys for years who have sort of understood these things intuitively and maybe couldn't explain them in an analytic way or have an analytic sort of reason for why they knew it was the smart play. But guys have made smart plays and played in these styles for years, and we just called them heady or, you know, high basketball IQ sorts of guys. But that for some players, these sorts of things are intuitive without the math and without the shot charts and the graphs and whatever.
I mean, it's, you know, have you seen a basketball court?
Yeah.
The 3-point arc is not really an arc. It's not like, it's not a semicircle.
Yeah.
What does that tell you? You know, tells you that on the ends, it's closer. I mean, it's, you know, that's, I don't think you need a PhD in computer science to sort that one out. So yeah, it is interesting. And I think, I mean, I think that's actually, I mean, now that you mention it, that's like a really interesting thing. Again, not from like a pure math analytical standpoint, but just from sort of a media standpoint, to look at, like, and maybe people have done this, that, like, who were the, like, and, you know, who would be the, like, analytical darlings of the 70s in baseball, you know?
Yeah. Well, somebody wrote a thing for us this year for Nylon Calculus this summer about Antoine Walker and about how maybe his execution was not quite up to par, but that his shot selection was like sort of the new analytic ideal, that he was a big man who took three-pointers and shot at the rim, and that was sort of it. You know, he's... You know, his reputation is as a guy who, like, sort of, like, didn't understand basketball and didn't really know his strengths and his weaknesses and, you know, sort of just went out there and did his thing. But, you know, in a slightly different context, looking at what he did in a slightly different way, you know, it fits with a lot of pieces that we've sort of think about differently now.
Yeah, and it makes you wonder if his legacy had been, you know, would be significantly different because, you know, people just look at him and think like he was just like a petulant whiner and he just wanted to and he wanted to shoot threes because he wanted to shoot threes.
Yeah.
You know, Twan gonna Twan, right? So like, if he wasn't like that, if people would look back and think like, well, no, he just knew what he was doing, you know?
Yeah. Well, and was he the guy, I remember the quote, but not the person, but I think he was the one who said, somebody asked him why he shot so many three-pointers, and he said, because there's no four-pointers.
Yeah.
you know, which was hysterical, and it was this big joke at the time, but, you know, when you think about it from an analytics standpoint, like, yeah, if there were four-pointers, we'd want to take those.
Hey, I mean, Dan Cortez and Bill Bellamy take them, so... Is that your first Rock and Jock reference in the R Squared podcast? I don't know.
It definitely is. I think maybe Seth would have caught that, but I think most of our guests have been too young for Rock and Jock references. Man.
Michael Rappaport, big, you know, 25-point shot guy.
Oh, yeah, he was one of my favorites. Yeah, he had a little resurgence. He was out for a couple of years, and then, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, they had him in, like, the celebrity game at All-Star Weekend again.
Okay.
And you know, he looked like he hadn't played basketball in 6 or 7 years since the last time he'd been in one of those games, and he was huffing and puffing up and down the floor and chucking shots, and, yeah, it was nice to see him out there again.
Go Michael. We all loved you in Copland.
Man. So who, basketball, who are you a fan of? Who do you root for? Who do you watch?
I am a tortured Sacramento Kings fan.
But so. Maybe not this year?
Yeah, you know, it's I'm not buying it. You know, I have sort of Stockholm, is that Stockholm syndrome? Like, yeah. I guess that's me. Like, I'm just afraid that, like, every time the door opens, I'm just, who is it? You know? I mean, so yeah, maybe not this year. It just seems too cute, right? I mean, really a valuable you know, valuable energy guy off the bench as a second, you know, second unit scoring guard. Mm-hmm. That's the problem with the team. Like, is that, yeah. I'm supposed to buy that Isaiah Thomas is really just the issue. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know if, I mean, and you know, maybe Boogie was working all summer. I guess he was with the national team, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, the West is just so, I mean, you know, go read Zach Lowe. It's just a bloodbath. Mm-hmm. It's just so brutal that, you know, they had this amazing start. I think I tweeted this that, you know, and they were like tied for the seventh seed, you know, I mean, and it was like, and everyone was like, this is as good as you could possibly be. And they're tied for the seventh seed, you know? So, yeah, yeah, I mean, I think finally if things are going a little better, but you know, it's the problem with being a Kings fan and having my particular predilections about sports, uh-huh. like about team compositions, is I look at all of the assets that have come in, the high draft picks and the trades, and I look at all the assets that have like left, and I'm like, oh my, how is that even possible? Like, you know, how is, you know, I don't understand how they make these trades, and you know, the all of this, you know, well, there goes another top six pick for nothing, you know, it's, but, you know, I mean, obviously I hope they really do well. And I hope someone like waves Jimmer and he signs like a 10-day at the end of the season and like hits a huge shot. And that's how they make the playoffs. I mean, that would be great.
Make a movie out of it. Yeah. So looking at the Kings and how they're running the team now, it's funny because, you know, Vivek has this reputation as, you know, there's the Malcolm Gladwell article about him and his daughter's basketball team that he coached, and they pressed, you know, the entire game, and they just looked at things totally differently, and he, you know, had no preconceived notions about basketball, and so he saw it differently than other people and saw this huge market inefficiency. And you sort of watch them since he's been in charge, and it seems like they're definitely zigging when other teams are zagging, you know, like the Darren Collison move and talking about him being a pass first point guard when, you know, a lot of the analytics seem to say that he wasn't, and, you know, picking up Rudy Gay last year when, you know, most of the analytics were pretty down on him. So are they catching a little bit of luck, or do you think they're really seeing things differently than everyone else is?
I mean, so, you know, Rudy Gay is a immensely talented basketball player, and I don't mean for the universe. I mean for the NBA. Yeah. I mean, for, you know what I mean. Like, he's when you score 25 points a game, there's only going to be 100 scored anyway. So, you know, you did okay. Like, yeah. I mean, again, that, you know, maybe I'm going to lose my stat geek card by saying things like that. But I mean, it's not like the guy sucks.
Yeah.
So, but you know, you know, so yeah, I do think they're zigging a little bit, or maybe zagging, depending on how you look at it. But you know, it remains to be seen how successful long term it'll be. I mean, the NBA, and that sort of goes back to my previous point that the NBA is just such a talent league. I mean, you can do, there are, you know, obviously, you know, people like to say the Spurs are so amazing, like they're some B team, right? Mm-hmm. Like Danny Green is horrible. You yeah. know what I mean? Like yes, the Spurs culture is great. Yes, Pop is I mean, bar none, the best coach in the NBA. And you know, I mean, and yes, the continuity they have allows them to do other things. But these are still NBA players, you know, and they're good ones at that, you know.
But there's that perception, like you look at Danny Green, and it's he washed out of how many other teams before, including the Spurs, before he sort of stuck and found his way. And so I feel like sometimes there's this perception that the Spurs, like they have some sort of magic potion, you know, that like that the only reason Danny Green is good is because he's there, and that if you just you know, if you just picked him up and put him on the Timberwolves or something, he would be terrible. And obviously his contributions and what he does well, like his value is elevated because it's in that system and because they use him in certain ways. But yeah, I feel like there is that perception that they take this like flotsam from other teams and turn it into useful parts, that it's about the Spurs and their system and not about those players actually being good.
But so they take this flotsam and they stick them in a team with on a lineup with three future Hall of Famers and one who in 5 years we might be talking about as a Hall of Famer. Like,
yeah.
Oh, it's amazing how well they do. I mean, you know, and the thing is there's, you know, across a number of different axes, like, I mean, now people are really starting to harp on the fact that, you know, the pop and the minutes thing, like, mm-hmm. that's not a joke. That's a real thing that has a tangible impact. And mm-hmm. so that may help. And, you know, the fact that, you know, that the teamwork and, you know, the offensive scheme and the unselfishness and all of that is sort of like a magic potion Spurs thing. But it's not like, you know, I mean, Danny Green was talented, you know? so it's, and so in some sense, it makes you wonder if other teams, you know, if they could do teamwork analytics, so to speak, as opposed to, like, you know, shot charting, 3D, whatever type analytics, if they could do sleep analytics. Mm-hmm. Hi, Kevin. if they could do, you know, those sorts of things, if those might move the needle a little bit more than, you know, where to take the shot or where not to take the shot, you know?
Well, it seems like those are sort of the you know, that's the just off the radar stuff, you know, now that SportView is sort of here and in and, you know, is in the hands of every team, that the, you know, biometric stuff, you know, like with Catapult Sports and Eric Weiss, I can't think of the name of his company, but they do sort of psychological work. And then I know there's the past couple of years, there's been researchers at Sloan who do stuff with sleep studies. And it seems like mm-hmm. That's, you know, that's the next market inefficiency to be exploited.
The irony, mm-hmm. And this sort of just occurred to me, is we don't need SportView in the NBA arenas. Because first of all, like, these are all ridiculously talented people, and they will make shots and they will miss shots. And, yeah. you know, we kind of know which ones are good and we kind of know which ones are bad. But it's five people running an offensive scheme with, you know, and if you can, with occasionally five different agendas. So yeah. we've seen what happens when you have one agenda. So, yeah. you know... What we need is SportView in the college arenas, because A, you know who tends to hang out in college arenas is college professors, so they know how to deal with that kind of data.
Yeah.
And B, that's what you need. Like, that kind of data would really help your draft valuation. So,
well, there's Duke has it, right?
Right. Duke, I think they're the only Duke, and then, you know, occasionally when they play. A game in what, the United Center in Chicago. Uh-huh. Like, that's, you know, if they play games in occasionally in NBA arenas,
or
then
Madison
then
Square
you get
Garden
it.
For the biggest yeah. tournament or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Then you'll occasionally get it, but mm-hmm. But yeah. So it is sort of interesting that you know, I wouldn't go so far as to say that the sport new stuff is passe, because I mean there's still tons of stuff to be gleaned from it, but mm-hmm. You know, there's only so much these franchises can do as far as resources are concerned, and you know, you have to think about what would make the most sense if and you know, there are people who think that you know, it to do really interesting stuff with that amount of data, mm-hmm. you kind of have to know what you're doing. I mean, that's not my necessarily area of expertise, so I'm not trying to be demeaning anybody, but it's complicated.
And that goes back to the technical barrier. The teams need a level of technical expertise and a staff and maybe a you know, a hardware infrastructure that may not be cost effective in terms of what sort of valuable insights they pull out of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, and what you just said ties uh-huh. into the buy-in thing because you know, it's debatable whether the information would translate to anything on court anyway, but even if it did, it's very debatable about whether you could actually implement it. So now what?
Yeah. You know? And I have no idea, but I wonder how many teams in the league now are manipulating the SportsView data on their own, and how much are simply working with the reports that Stats prepares and sends using the SportsView data.
Yeah, and then a third sort of echelon would be if they're consulting with Second Spectrum, you know,
mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, just that you know, they have, you know, I don't know, you know, I don't know exactly who's with them and who's not, but they yeah. have obviously some clients and are doing, you know, I would assume amazing stuff given the intelligence of the people in that room.
Mm-hmm. And so Second Spectrum, for anybody who's not aware, they've authored two of the last three winning papers at Sloan. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
And you have some familiarity with them because they're also affiliated with USC, is that right?
Yeah. One of one of my big talking points, I guess, when I was calling back to the data availability issue, was that the paper that won at Sloan that won Best Paper 2 years ago was authored under a USC affiliation, and the paper that won Best Paper last year was authored under a Second Spectrum affiliation. Same people.
Yeah.
So it just goes to the, there was this brief shining window where where this was sort of an academic pursuit, and now, boom, now people realize, hey, there's some real stuff you can do here, and now it's closed off to the franchises and partners.
And so for a company like Second Spectrum, what do they have to offer on top of, what a team can sort of do on their own?
Well, I mean, I don't want to speak for them, directly, but the assumption is that what they can offer is the stuff that a team can't do on their own. Rajiv Maheswaran, who's a CEO, is a ridiculously intelligent and talented person. And there is not 30 of him. So, and he's hired a really great team, and Yuhan Chen and the other people that Jeff that work there, they're really, really, really talented. They're very, very bright. So, Rajiv came to my class and spoke at the end of last semester. And one of the things he said about Second Spectrum, because the students were asking questions about sort of the company, is he said that, the people that he hires obviously have a passion about sports, but they probably have a passion, more about solving problems. And if they weren't solving really hard problems in sports, they would be solving really hard problems somewhere else. And that caliber of person is really hard to find, and it's also really hard to find and pay $62,000 a year.
So, those financial restrictions.
Right. So, I can't speak to what Second Spectrum pays their employees, but he, in the class, Rajiv did say that it was industry competitive, and he meant technical industry, not sports industry. So being able to do that is a level of sort of scale and sophistication that most organizations or most franchises can't really compete with. Some are trying. I mean, Philadelphia is trying, Houston is trying, there may be some others that are trying. That's going to be tough to do.
Well, we're running short on time. I've taken up a lot of your evening, but I want to spin back to just a couple personal questions before we go. So I'm wondering about your, given your professional expertise and your personal fandom, is there a line for you when you're watching a game? When you're following the Kings as a fan of the Kings, how much attention do you pay to analytics, and how much are you sort of like, that's my day job, I'd like to separate from that and just enjoy the basketball?
The one aspect that we actually haven't talked about is sort of like scouting. So I actually, when I watch sports, be it basketball or other sports, but basketball, I actually, if I'm going to focus on something that's, sort of at a level above just like watching it sort of blankly and seeing the score tick by, I actually try to watch it from like a scout's perspective. I try to look at people's footwork. I try to look at if I'm watching football, for example, what defense are they running here? Like, what patterns are they at? If I'm watching, basketball, I look at, the flow of the offense and things like that, but not necessarily, again, from an analytical standpoint, more from a just sort of knowing how the game works, trying to teach myself, again, as much as I can about how the game works, which, little plug here, if you're looking to work in sports, that is vitally important. That kind of knowledge of, sort of like a scout's knowledge of the game is vitally important.
It's funny because the first couple episodes I did of this podcast, that was always the question that I ended with, was like, what do you look at when you're watching a game? And one of the people that I had on at the beginning one of the early episodes was Zach Lowe, and I just sort of imagined that when he watched the game, he sort of was telestrating in his head, and little arrows were popping up in little circles and stuff like that. And he said some really interesting things about that he separates sometimes when he's watching a game, and that he's not sort of specific and detail oriented, and then he's maybe looking for some more general things, and then goes back and looks for the specifics later. But you're into that minutia as you're watching.
I mean, you know, it comes and goes, and depends on the yeah. context. You know, if I'm at a bar with you know three beers in my hand, then probably not so much. So I live in Hermosa Beach. It happens.
Yeah.
But you know, yeah. If I'm by myself and I'm you know sort of interested in that, then yeah, that tends to be what I look at. Uh-huh. You know.
Well, we haven't verified, but my supposition has been that Daryl Morey, when he watches basketball games, that it's like the Matrix. He just sees like a stream of code. Yeah, a stream of code just you know just waving in front of his eyes, and yeah, if we looked, we wouldn't be able to see basketball players or hoops or a court or anything. It would just be little ones and zeros.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you giving us an hour to talk about all this stuff, and I really enjoyed it. And we'll definitely have you on again sometime later this year if you're game.
I am. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jeremy.